Well, good morning. My name is Steve, and I am an alcoholic. I am a member, an active member of a very active group in Columbus, Ohio, the Three Legacies Group. Either you've heard about us or you're here. But we have a rotating format. We do steps, traditions, and concepts on the first 3 weeks and a lead speaker meeting on the fourth week. And if there's a fifth week, we have an open discussion, closed discussion on sponsorship. So we have that. And we read the literature and we have people come in and talk. And so over a couple of years, we get through every step, tradition, and concept, reading it and talking about it. And so it's a really good meeting. If you're in the Columbus area sometime on a Sunday night, feel free to stop by and have some fun with us. By the grace of God and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since May the 11th, 1977. And that sent chills up my back for some reason there. So that is very nice. Our topic today is just for today. We have three scheduled speakers. Two are here. One is in the moment somewhere else. So, but if Laura were to come in while we are going, we will shepherd her up here. Otherwise, I'll probably have to figure out something to say. I figure I got about 20 minutes to figure that out. And those who know me know that me saying something has never been the problem. So, could we begin the meeting with a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries over the past 75 years. So we have a couple of speakers from different places to speak on the topic of just for today. Our first speaker today is going to be Barbara S. from British Columbia.
Hi. Is that all right? I'm Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Barbara.
And my home group is Any Length in Victoria on Vancouver Island. Beautiful British Columbia. So if you're ever up that way in your downtown Victoria, you can just walk over to the Church of Our Lord. And there we are Tuesday nights. We're a 12 by 12 meeting. And I think one of the better groups in Victoria. First of all, I want to say thank you to my beautiful higher power for the amazing and miraculous opportunity to be here today, to be able to share this time and this moment, these moments with you. Secondly, I want to thank the instruments of God's grace, the GSO, Rick, for inviting me. I want to thank my friends that are at home right now and praying for me at this very moment. And I want to thank Gail and for helping me to get here. I've been thinking a lot about this just for today and over the past few weeks since I got that letter. And I was trying to compose a thesis and really I wanted to be very, you know, witty and clever, and last night I was thinking even more about it and trying to remember my talk that I'd rehearsed and memorized. I was standing in a lineup at a drugstore, and the lady in front of me was critiquing one of the speakers she'd heard the night before, and I thought, oh God, I don't want to hear that. And I remembered how many times I've sat out there and done the same thing. So here I am. I'm going to bumble along. I'm going to forget the important things and tell you what God wanted me to say. My mother was 15 when she married my dad, and he was 17. And so those two kids got married and had three kids. I was the oldest. And I always hate to introduce my dad as a violent alcoholic because he was so much more than that. He was handsome, he was intelligent, he was a hunter, he taught me so many good things. But in my early childhood, my dad was a dangerous and unhappy person. And so the very first time I started to hear the principle of just for today was from my mother. My mom would often say to me, when I went without clothing, food, shelter, safety, she'd say to me, it's just for now. It's just for today. Someday things are going to get better. And so as I grew up, I came to believe that the world owed me, that somehow, someday out there, there was a big IOU, the world to me, that was going to make up for all the things I didn't get, for all the love I didn't get, for the clothes that would have made me be the right person, for and I also, I had dreams. I wanted to be, I wanted to go to university, I wanted to be a writer, and instead, all I could think of was how can I get out of this home as quick as I could, and that's what I did. At 17, I left home, and I got a job in a bank, which was quite remarkable, because if there was one subject I consistently failed throughout school, it was math. I couldn't add or subtract. The times tables baffled me. But there I was in a bank. I was a loans and mortgage officer. Just about right off the get-go, I was smart that way and for credit. And away I went. So I was working in a bank. And then I very quickly, not long after that, when I was 18, I met a boy who was ambitious like I was and drank like I was. And so we got married, and us two kids, we had kids. And so you can sort of see how this story's going to go. In the big book, or I think it's the 12 and 12, alcohol is called the rapacious creditor. And the first time I drank, it was like that was a small down payment on what the world owed to me. All of a sudden, that first drink, that first drunk, I felt like a little piece of Barbara got let out or whole. I got a little piece of me. And so I decided that alcohol was the missing part of me. So every chance I got, I drank. And so I had married this guy, and away we went. And for a few years, we were pretty much weekend drinkers. I had two kids, Brian and Melissa, and but as it turned out, that the boy I married turned out to be kind of like the man my father was, and so my weekend drinking very easily became daily drinking because he was. Well, this is how it would go. I'd say, well, I'm just drinking for now, just for today, because when we get a divorce or he gets a job or the bills are paid or the kids grow up, things will be better, and I don't need to drink like this. But just for now, just for today, this is how what I need, and I need to drink. So that went on until one day I was sitting at the kitchen table. It was just an ordinary day. There was no big crisis other than the normal crisis of two alcoholics raising two children. And I was sitting there, and I had a quiet time. And it was the strangest thing. It just came to me that I had recreated my home life, my childhood. I had recreated for my children. And it was the beginning of that awakening when I started to put the pieces together. When I made that phone call, I told the woman, I said, I'm really afraid that if I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to lose my kids. And she said to me, If you say you're a sober alcoholic, you'll get to keep your kids. So on March the 6th, 1985, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Courtney Alano Club. At that meeting, I heard that there was only one day I didn't need to drink, and that was that day, that I didn't need to say I was going to quit drinking for the rest of my life. All I had to say was that just for today, you don't have to drink. And another thing they said to me was go to a meeting every day and don't drink between meetings. And I understood that. I got that. So they said, don't think about Christmas. Don't think about summer. Don't think about camping. Just today. Just don't drink today. And another old timer told me, she said, how to stay in the day. She said she would imagine that at the end of the day there was this big, like a castle door with big bolts and bars across it, and that was the end of the day, and she couldn't go past that. And that helped me too, because when I was 3 weeks sober, my marriage ended because we had nothing left in common. My sponsor Marguerite W., she gave me a big book and she told me not to read it. She told me to study it. She also told me, she gave me that little wonderful little Al-Anon bookmark just for today. And that was so helpful. All those things, and they were such new ideas, because I never lived in today. I was always, someday things are going to get better. Someday. So there I was. I was 30 years old. I was sober. I had a 4- and a 6-year-old. He was gone, and I was on welfare. And I looked at my life, and I said to God, I can't do this. I can't. So, God, this is the deal. Like an alcoholic, I said, first of all, you got to be my husband because he's gone. And next of all, you got to be a daddy. You got to be a daddy to my kids, and you got to be a daddy to me too. And in the big book, it says right in there, you're my employer, so you got to be my employer. And the other thing is, I gave God all of me, and I said, I'm sorry if this sounds really crude, but it's the truth. I gave God the space between my ears and my legs and said, I need to stay focused. I want to raise these kids. I do not want to have my kids have a series of, you know, Uncle Bob's, Uncle Jack's, and Uncle Tom's. They lost their dad. They don't need to lose their mom. And now I'm sober. So away I went. Away I went, and I got totally involved in AA. I was sponsored, and the time mounted, the days went by, and things got good. I did get to go to do some schooling, and those kids were growing up, and before I knew it, I was 15 years sober, and still single, and God, I came to understand, didn't seem to mind if I ever had sex again. So watch out what you give them. Just for today, you can do just about anything. So when I was 15 years sober, my sponsor, who I loved more than anything else in the world, because while I was raising my kids, she was raising me, and she got cancer, she got lung cancer, and she died in 10 days. And I got to sit with her, and we don't know this, that when you're here, that you know, we help each other live, and sometimes we're called to help each other die. And I got to sit with her to her last breath. I have to say that I did not understand grief. I thought that grief meant that you just sat down and you cried for a while and then you bucked up and got on with life. But in fact, what I found was that grief is a form of insanity. And sober, I went insane. I went to a doctor, and I wanted to feel better, so he put me on Prozac, and I didn't feel much better, so we kept upping it until I was on 100 milligrams of Prozac a day. And you know, when you're taking that much Prozac, you don't have any more bad ideas. Every day is a good day, and any idea you have is a good idea. And so it was a good idea to mortgage my house, because now I had some money because my dad had died and I had an inheritance. And now, you know, that big IOU, that was time to pay up. The world owed me. So what I did was I went shopping for 3 years, basically, to cheer up. And and I was going to meetings and, you know, sponsoring and being sponsored and talking the talk. And but I never told the truth. And because I'd had banking experience, I really knew how to tell bankers what they want to hear. And so I told bankers what they wanted to hear, and I got a lot of credit. I mortgaged my house to the hilt, and the day came when I couldn't pay my bills, and I had to file for bankruptcy. At 16 years sober, I lost everything. I used to know this old-timer in the program. She'd say, "Barb, at some point in every alcoholic sobriety, you will stand alone in the garden naked with God." And when she'd say that, I'd think of Eden. I'd think of tropical flowers and birds and babbling brooks. And let me tell you what my garden turned out to be. Because I was destitute, I had to go somewhere, and my family was fed up. And so I ended up taking a job at an oil rig camp in northern Alberta. I was 150 kilometers southwest of Grand Prairie, Alberta, in the middle of nowhere. And when I was there, I had nothing. There was nothing. And there, that was my garden. When I was stripped of everything, and it was just me, and I found out that God had wanted to get my attention. So when I was there, I did another fourth and fifth step, and I got honest. And so I said, "God, I cannot work at this oil rig camp because I'm a cleaner. I was making beds and cleaning toilets and washing floors. And it was supposed to be a dry camp, but it wasn't. It was totally wet. And I was the only sober person in the camp. But I said, okay, one day at a time, I can do this job. And I had my big book, I had a Bible, I had my sponsor's picture. And every day I would write out another resentment. And on the 12th day, I had written out my big resentments I had. And I took them out to burn the garbage, which is one of my jobs. And while I was doing that, I was watching the smoke in the air, my fourth and fifth step going up to God, and the cook came out and said, "You're fired." So I was there for 12 days, but I had finished. And I got it. I understood that the work was done. So I went back to Victoria. I had made enough money, $1,200 a day, $1,200, back to Victoria, and I started over with a sleeping bag and an air mattress, and I got a job cleaning houses. When I turned 50, I had this idea. Well, one of the things I've learned about how God talks to us, to me, is he's consistent and persistent. And I had this little niggling idea, and that I'd always wanted to go to university. So I thought, well, while I'm doing this job, I will take one course and I'll find out if it's a dream or if it's something to let go. So I did the one course. I absolutely loved it, and I kept on going. And so what I really want to get to the point and tell you is that this January, let's see what happened. Well, first of all, yeah, so I went to school. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that I was 50 years old and I was in first year university. And I started writing courses, and my kids had grown up, and they had all gone. I I forgot to mention that 4- and 6-year-old. Well, I'll get back to them. I'll tell you about them. Anyway, so there I was in university. And so this January, I signed a book contract for the story of the oil rig camp, for 12 days at an oil rig camp. Thank you. And in March, I took a cake for 25 years of sobriety. And in just this month, I've convocated. So I've graduated with a Bachelor of Arts with distinction as a writing major. So at home, I've got this on the wall, right? That's the degree. But the real degree that I wanted to tell you about was Brian and Melissa, because I think that, you know, there's so much talk in AA now, and there's so many slogans, and just for today is one of them, that and cliches that we hear that sometimes I think over time start to lose their meaning. And I think that the real meaning in your recovery, my recovery, is in the results in my life that you can see, that are tangible. And the main two results in my life are my son and my daughter. They were 4 and 6, I mentioned, when I got sober. My son, he had a lot of disabilities that weren't treated until I got sober, because I hadn't noticed that he couldn't hardly walk or talk. And so when he went into kindergarten, they told me that he'd never be in a regular classroom setting, that they didn't usually see kids this old with these kinds of disabilities, because they usually came when they were born. So Brian, he was 4 when I got sober. He graduated. And why I'm telling you this, as I want you to know what God can do. I want you to know what the love in this program can do. Because all the time I was getting sober, and Marguerite was saying to me, and I was saying to Marguerite, my God, look what I've done to my kids. You know, yeah, I'm going to get sober, and yes, I have this fellowship, but who's taken care of Brian and Melissa? And Marguerite would say to me, you get well. You get this program, and just like your disease poisoned your children, your recovery will heal and bless them. So Brian graduated from high school with honors in computer science. He is now an audio engineer in Montreal. He works for Ubisoft. And he's 30 years old. And my daughter, I was 6 years old when I got sober, and she cried all the time. She was in a special needs classroom. She was pulling out her hair, pulling out her eyelashes. She was afraid of me. And she is now, she went on to university. She's a registered nurse. She lives in Massett. She is happily married and is about to give me my 3rd grandchild. So the point is, The point is that I started out to talk to you about 2 kids, and the 2 kids really were my mom and my dad. That alcoholism is a family disease, that it's generation to generation to generation, and we all tell each other, just for today, just for now. But so I wanted to tell you, like, between my mom and my dad and my son and my daughter, that legacy of alcoholism is broken. That recovery has come to my family, to my grandchildren. That you don't know when you come here to get sober that you're saving the lives and changing lives that aren't even born yet. It's unbelievable to me. So the final thing on Just for Today, this is how I understand it. That God has made this incredibly beautiful place that turns around. He's given us light and dark and day and night. And part of what my job is to surrender to the day, to the day. And that little slogan, when I really understand that the planet's going to go around one day and I get another ride on it, that it lessens my sorrow. Because it has a beginning and an end. just like a day, right? Morning and night. And it deepens my joy because I understand that joy too is a passing thing. So when I have beautiful things in my life, people I love, friends that I grow old with in sobriety, I appreciate them all the more because I know that it's temporal, it's passing. So I think that's all I have to say. I'm so, so grateful. This has just been amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. And it's always good to be reminded that this program, when we get it and we practice it, does reverse the damage we've done and provides opportunities for our children. I have five children. One of them is in the program now. Two of my daughters, one is married and one is engaged to members of this fellowship, who they found without my help. And it's just amazing how this thing kind of works that way, if we just live it like that. Our next speaker has brought the entire state of Oregon with her, it appears. Marilyn H. from Oregon.
I'm Marilyn, I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank all my tri-godders for coming out to support me today, and all the people that aren't in our tri-god group, you better join. And I want to thank my sponsor and my sister sponsees for being here. It means a lot to me. And my friend Eric, way in the back, who's from Toronto. Wow, look what you guys have done, you know? This has been an incredible conference so far. And yesterday, if you missed the talk on the clergy in AA, you need to get that CD because it's phenomenal. And this bishop gave a global amends for the church. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was unbelievable. And then the one on the military was really interesting, too, and I learned a whole different language. There's a whoo and a whoo and a huh. It's like, okay, through the whole meeting, whoo, wah, wah. Whoa, okay, whoa, all right. So that's my new thing right now, so I'll try not to do it too much. I'm kind of into it, though. It was kind of interesting. And I want to share this experience because I love at the internationals, there's things that happen that can only happen here, you know, because we take over the entire town. And I was invited to a very nice dinner the other night, and this doesn't have anything to do with just for today because it was 2 days ago, but nonetheless, it's still with me, and you'll understand in a minute. And we're at this it was a very nice restaurant, you know, like where they put the napkin on your lap. I'm like, oh, okay. So anyway, and there's probably like 12 tables in the room, 10, 12 tables. And, you know, we're all wearing these at all the tables. And, when you go to a fancy restaurant, they often have desserts that have liquor in it, right? So you always ask and blah, blah, blah. So they had baked Alaska, and I'd never even seen baked Alaska before. And so we're all sitting there eating, and all of a sudden the waitress pulls out this cart, and it has this big, you know, thing of like, I don't know what baked Alaska is. It looks like whipped cream, but I don't know what that is up there. And then there's this huge bottle of Grand Marnier, and it's like gorgeous. You know, it has that seal on it, and everybody in the whole restaurant's like, whoa. You know, it like everybody's talking, all of a sudden it got dead quiet. And we're like, wow. You know, and then we're all looking, who's getting that, right? Like, who would dare to get that here, you know? And there's one lady sitting by herself in the corner. She's not wearing one of these. She's gorgeous, and she's getting this whole bacon. And then, you know, they pour it in the pan. They flame it up, you know, and it's like, whoo, on fire. And everybody's just like, And then it smells, the wafting smell of it. It's like, oh my God, you know? And then she goes to pour it over the thing, and it's like dripping flames and oozing down onto this white, beautiful thing. And she gets done with this, everybody in the restaurant. It was fantastic, you know? And then we all had to laugh about it because it's just not something you see every day, but, only, you know, alcoholics would be that enthralled with it, right? And it's still with me even, right? Anyway, the topic is just for today, and I want to read something from As Bill Sees It, one of my favorite pieces of literature. I thought I had it marked. I do. It's from page 284. It's called Faith, a Blueprint and Work. I'm just going to read a portion of it. It's from a letter in 1954. The idea of 24-hour living applies primarily to the emotional life of the individual. Emotionally speaking, we must not live in yesterday nor tomorrow. But I have never been able to see that this means the individual, the group, or AA as a whole should give no thought whatever to how to function tomorrow or even in the more distant future. Faith alone never constructed the house you live in. There had to be a blueprint and a lot of work to bring it into reality. It goes on a little bit further to talk about faith without works is dead. But I love that that thought of the emotional life. Because when I was growing up in the alcoholic home I grew up in, you know, my dad died when I was 16, and he died, you know, upstairs in our house in his own urine, cold and yellow. And when I was a kid growing up in that alcoholic home, living in the now was not a good thing. And so I learned at a really young age how to fantasize, how to get out of myself. I mean, I could just sit in a room and be somewhere else. You know, I would imagine I was Julie Andrews, and I could be running on those mountaintops and singing, and I wanted to be in a musical so bad. I wanted my life to be in a musical, and I just wanted out, and I thought, you know, someday I'm going to get out of here, and my life's going to be better. You know, someday it's going to get better, like what you're talking about. You know, it's going to be better out there, and I know that when I grow up and I get what I want in life, everything's going to be good, and when I'm successful and when I'm powerful. And the truth was is that from a very young age, I was so messed up inside myself. I was so emotionally involved in myself, and it wasn't a good thing because I never thought of myself better than you. For some reason, I believed from the very get-go of my life that I was worse than you, that I was less than you. Nobody ever told me that, but I believed it inside my guts. And I was so involved in myself and so scared of you that by the time I took my first drink, it was a relief. I understood why my dad drank when I got my first drink. You know, I was so scared. And then alcohol gave me that courage. I felt like I, you know, just needed to get out of Southern California because I wasn't blonde. And I just had to get the hell out of there. I don't like the beach. I had to go. And, you know, I had a talent as a dancer, and I got to go to New York City. And it was during the disco era, and I got to party in those discos in Studio 54, and it was fantastic. And it was like just from the moment, and alcohol made me feel whole and special and powerful. And there was no way I was going to quit it. There was just no way I could give that up. And I kept thinking, though, you know, that what alcohol did for me is it kept me in the moment. Because every time that I was not into just for the moment, just today, just now, it was unmanageable. It was like pure hell. It was unholy. You know, that feeling of that pressure of the now, of realizing who I was and what a scum I was and how scared I was and how much better you were than me and how I envied you. I was so riddled with envy. I didn't know how to live in the world, and alcohol just made it okay for me. Of course, I wasn't going to give that up. And I ended up having to get knee surgery. I opted for it so I could drink every day. And my dad, when my dad was alive, he would go to AA meetings. And he was in and out of meetings. And when he would go to AA, you know, he would stay sober. And then he would quit going to AA and he wouldn't stay sober. So in the back of my mind, I knew that if it ever got bad, I'd have to turn myself into you. And that happened, you know, it got bad and I had to turn myself in, and I called AA, and I was devastated, and I was 23 years old, and I knew my life was over. I knew it was going to suck. I knew it was going to be boring from here on out, but I could not live in the present with that kind of fear, self-hatred, and hatred towards you as well at this point. I just couldn't live in the world, and so I thought I'd give AA a try. And I went to a meeting, and, you know, you guys just loved me. You took care of me. You taught me everything I know. I have learned everything from you guys. you know, I got a sponsor, and she was loving and kind to me. She was a little, you know, a little too much Miss AA for me, but, you know. But she was loving and kind, and I woke up, you know, I was in graduate school, and I didn't know it, and I was not dancing at the time, but I was in graduate school, and I remember I was, like, sitting in class, and I didn't even know how to do it. I didn't know how to live life without alcohol. How do you have a conversation? How do you meet people? How do you hang out in a room? How do you sit in a room like this without alcohol? I mean, think about it, really, right? And I was, I didn't know how to go through my day. I remember I was sitting in a philosophy of dance class, and I'm like, what are these people talking about? I'm like, you know, because philosophy is pretty intense, you know, and I'm like, I don't even understand what they're talking about. And I would get so scared, and I'd have to call her up, and I'd say, I don't know what to do. And she'd say, just get on your knees and pray. And I'd go, okay. And we didn't have cell phones, you know, so I'd have to, you know, go over to the payphone after every class. I'd go, I don't know what to do. She'd go to the next class. You know, I go, oh, okay. Do you know what I mean? I was like, I called her like 3 or 4 times a day. She was on disability. It was great for me, bad for her. But, you know, worked out well for me. And she taught me how to get through the day. I never had that. I had never known about being in the now. I didn't really ever want to be in the now. And truthfully, in early sobriety, I didn't want to be there either. But for some reason, I believed what you guys told me. She took me through the steps, you know, and through the process of the steps, you know, we learn so much about ourselves, right? And in the middle of my ninth step was probably one of the most profound spiritual experiences I ever had. Because I was driving down Pico Boulevard, and I stopped at this stop sign, no, it was a stoplight, and I looked over, and there's a woman sitting next to me in a car, fancy woman, put together woman, blonde woman. All blondes were on my resentment list. But this was my ninth step, so I was kind of, you know, kind of a little over it. And I looked over at her, and she was one of those beautiful put-together women, you know, with nails and, you know, just beautiful. I could never do that. Her bra and underwear probably matched, you know. But I looked over at her, and for the first time in my life, I had a feeling inside my entire body that I belonged on this earth, that I was a part of. I had never felt that in my entire life. And for that moment of time, it was a miracle. And that's, you know, what I have to remember, those moments of time, you know. And if that was all you guys would have given me, it would have been enough. But I've gotten so much more. We were laughing the other day because the old-timers used to say, well, if you have 1 foot on yesterday and 1 foot on tomorrow, you're pissing all over today. You know, I don't know if you hear that anymore, but they used to say that a lot. And it's definitely a male perspective there. we were kind of laughing about that. The process of the steps, they humble us. You know, you get to that 10th step, and it talks about on page 86, right, about how we live through each day. You know, if you're not there, it's really good. It's really worth it. But there's a, you know, that's the blueprint. The blueprint for living for me is in that page right there. Through the course of my, the other thing I need to tell you about is Jeannie. I want to talk to you about Jeannie real quick, because Jeannie was, she was my grand sponsor, and she was an amazing woman, and she was there for people and gave to people like you wouldn't believe. And I'm going to share this moment because I don't usually talk about this moment, but it was important for me because I was so scared of you. And I was, you know, such a people pleaser. I did whatever you told me, and I would burn inside with thoughts of hatred for you, but I could never tell you about it. You know, I would just burn inside, you know, and smile on the outside and have all this evil, you know, from here back, you know. And so I remember this one girl had asked me to sponsor her, and it was the first person that asked me to sponsor her, and I had just about a year sober. And so we went and had lunch. We were going to have lunch and talk about it, you know. And the waiter brought me food, and it wasn't what I wanted. And I was like, oh, that's all right. She's like, are you going to give it back? I said, no, it's all right. I'll eat this. And she was like, okay. And so we get done, and then we get done with our meal, and we go in the bathroom. And she says, she's in the stall next to me. She goes, I don't think I want you as my sponsor. And I'm like, what? And we're like side by side in the stalls. You know, she's not even looking at me. And instantly, I, like, burst with tears, right? Instantly, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm getting rejected. oh my God, you know, and keep it together, you know, because you're being rejected. She hates you and you're a scum. And then, you know, she's peeing and she says, yeah, because, you know, if I can't even have a sponsor who won't turn her food back in, you know, when it's not what she wants, you know, I don't want that. You don't have what I want. And I was like, oh my God. And I was so devastated. And I called up Jeannie. I said, Jeannie, this woman, she said, oh, God bless her. Look at the lesson she's teaching you. And I'm thinking, God bless her. I said, you know, I said, she devastated me. And Jeannie says to me, I said, well, Jeannie, and plus I'm a people pleaser. And she goes, bullshit. I go, yes, I am. She goes, you're a liar and a coward. She says to me, if you had a few, you'd take them off at the knees. I go, she's right. She's right. Those are the kinds of things that I need to help keep me in the moment and take me through the day. Do you know what I mean? Through the moment. Through the moment. Things that cut through this kind of self-centeredness, right? That kind of stuff for me. Another thing that happened recently, you know, I sometimes get asked to do this, and I always get really nervous, and I, you know, they say it's not about you, but it sure feels like it when before you get up here, and I hate it. And but it's an honor and a privilege, do not get me wrong. But I called my sponsor, and I was, like, terrified. And she said, oh, Marilyn, she said, Marilyn, you carry a good message, but you're no Chuck C. And that's what I need. You know, that's what I need. I just need to be taken out of my head of self-centeredness and my own fear and just be brought down to the present moment, you know. Throughout my sobriety, so in the middle part of my sobriety was all about just for today for me was enduring. How to get through this day, how to get through this moment. How to get through, you know, just get me through the day and I'll see if I can do it. And throughout my sobriety, I've had some pretty big days like that where it's like, just get me through today, you know. It was actually 7 years ago today that my ex-husband went into a coma. And he's alive. Don't freak out here yet. He went into a coma. And tomorrow we medevaced him up to UW for liver transplant, and he's sitting in the front row today, 7 years later, alive and well. Today's his 27th year of sobriety. So, but that was a day, let me tell you. That was a day. That was a day. And my sponsor helped get me through, and my best friend at the time helped get me through that. And it was an amazing thing. The fact that he's sitting in the front row today is due to good sponsor direction. And we're friends, and it's an amazing thing. And just know that I will always have 60 more days than him, hopefully, a day at a time. Just one, oh, 69, he tells me. All right, even better. You know, and in this last few years of my sobriety, you know, I've gone through stuff. You went through that, went through a divorce, a pretty public divorce, and my sponsor wouldn't let me leave my home group meeting. And I'm like, yeah, well, when you went through yours, you had like 800 people. We have like 60 in our group, you know. It's like a little different. My case is different, you know, but it's not. And it was the right thing, you know. Here's what helps me get through the day is just having a voice that's louder than my head, which is my sponsor's. This last year, I went through a couple things that were really intense for me personally, and I always like to share a little bit about where I'm at today. Oh. God, I don't want to talk about this. Maybe I won't. Yeah, okay. My daughter, and I can't share, I just have to share in a general way about this because it's not mine to tell. My daughter went through something horrible, and I just found out about it a little while ago. And it was one of those things that as a mother you would just never want to know about. And I've never been in so much pain in my sobriety. And I was actually homicidal. Good sponsor, louder than my head. Help me through that. And I had to turn to meditation and prayer in a way I hadn't before. And I started rocking that 11th step. And the 11th step, I could, in all honesty, was always too goody-good for me. I could, it's like, are you kidding? How does one really do that? It's like, please, you know? I can only get through the first line. Really, make me a channel of that peace. That was good enough for me. That's really, I mean, the rest of it seemed like way, you know, way too much for me. An alcoholic like me, I can't do all that stuff. You know, it's beyond my capacity. And it actually is. But for some reason, that prayer just kept coming up over and over. And what that's done for me is it's brought in a whole different understanding for me of actually just for today. It's calmed my spirit. It's given me a new hope. And it's not, that prayer is not what I thought it was. I thought that I had to like be all those things, and I can't be all those things. If you don't know the prayer, you can check it out. It's in the 12 and 12. But I can't be all those things. But what I can do each day is do my best to see what I can contribute to you, to do my best to see what I can bring forth into this world. And that's, you know, the beauty of having some time in the program and having a little bit more grace, I guess it would, you would say. Yesterday, in that clergy meeting, this priest was talking about when they're trying to train young priests about addiction and alcoholism. He said the way to get them is when they're in seminary, when they're still forming, when they're formative. Because once they've had their been laid on by the hand, I guess they do that, and then you're like something else. Something happens. I don't know. I didn't really understand that part, but something goes on. But yeah. So anyway, he was talking about that you got to get them when they're formative. And I was thinking about that struck me because, you know, that part in the 11th step where it talks about, you know, dying, that I must die today to have eternal life. And I understood that because lately all I really ask for is just to die each day inside my ego and to let God just do what God's supposed to do with me and to stay formative every day. And that's not something that I can just think about. I mean, I have to really pray for that and really in earnest seek that. And I get a certain peace that I've never experienced. Let's see. You already know. My sobriety date is, April 27th, 1983. I have 27 years of sobriety. I'm 50 years old. And I'm just learning this stuff now. You know what I mean? I'm just now getting it. A little glimmer. I shouldn't say getting it. Because then I'm not formative. Then I'm like this. I got this. Then I got this going on, right? When I was new, this was required reading. It's a little thing called Just for Today. I can't quote from it because it's Al-Anon. Didn't know that. Probably wouldn't have been into it. But we were handed this. This was on the literature tables. And I remember reading this going, oh, my God, yes, yes. And I've read this recently. I'm like, are you kidding? That's a lot of stuff to do. I'm like, that, what an order, you know. But I was brand new, and I'm like, yes, yes. You know, and then I realized, oh, well, I was new. I didn't do it. I just read about it. You know, and then I thought I was doing it because I was reading about it, right? You know, I do that a lot. I think I'm doing a 10th step because I've thought about it, but I haven't really done it. But I thought about it, you know. Anyway, I've learned a lot. When I was when this topic came up, you know, I was really a little bit thrown. I'm like, why can't it just be one day at a time? Why does it have to be just for today? You know, so I started asking around, which is always interesting when you do an AA, right? Asking people, so what do you think about just for today? What's the difference between just for today and one day at a time? You know, because I had to, you know, get ready, prepare. Like, you know, what's the big deal with that? And I was really kind of thrown for a loop because all I could think about was this. And I'm like, I can't quote from that because it's not AA conference approved. And it's like, okay, great. And so I got a lot of different things like, well, just for today is action or, you know, as opposed to a concept of one time, one day at a time. I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, I thought about that too. And, you know, I got a lot of different answers. And that was even more confusing. And then when I got here and I looked in the archives, and, you know, they had those, if you haven't looked at them, they're fascinating. They have those big reprints of articles that were in early, like in the 40s and 30s of newspaper articles. And it's really fascinating because just the verbiage is cool, you know. And there was one with this lady sitting there on this chair and they're injecting her with something. And it's like, whoa, you know, it's like the woman alcoholic. Oh, it's very dramatic. It's very, very dramatic. Anyway, so I opened it up when I go, I'm just going to open it up. And it was February 29th, 1944. And I couldn't really tell what paper it was from. But it says, the psychological part of the program is usually tackled first. It helps the alcoholic get honest with himself. He learns a simple rule for staying sober, the 24-hour plan. Each day he tries to resist John Barleycorn for that day only, and he finds that in that way he can face it, taking it one day at a time. And I love that because there you have the 24-hour, you got the just for today, and you got the one day at a time. And I thought that was fascinating that I just turned that over. Opened up the book, and there it was. You know, and that's how God takes care of me today. And God takes care of me in so many ways that I don't even know. And I'm just, like I said, I'm just starting to get a little glimmer. Again, I just want to thank my AA family and Eugene for being here. It means the world to me. Thank my partner, my sponsor. My sponsor who rocks my world. I think that's all I got. Thank you for my life so much.
Wow. Thank you, Marilyn. Laura G. from Texas, did you sneak in on us while we were speaking, Laura? I was thinking one of the nice things when I got the letter and asked me to chair a panel is I said, well, that's nice because I don't have to speak, which means I won't spend 6 months thinking about what I'm going to say. And I didn't. Interestingly, this morning I did. I said, what happens if I have to say something? And so I was struck by, I remember the idea of one day at a time or just for a day. When I first got sober, it seemed overwhelming. I mean, it was the hugest challenge. It was a doable challenge, but it was the biggest challenge that I could face and do. I couldn't do two. I wasn't convinced I could do more, but I could do the one. But it seemed like just an overwhelming challenge to limit myself to a day. Today I kind of think it's too much time. We say a lot. I say that because I can be sitting up here focusing on the speakers and wondering how I'm going to get a better seat at the Alamo Dome tonight. You know, at the same time my head will shoot off somewhere else, and it's still within the day, but it's not where I think I need to be, and which is here, now, in the moment. That's kind of where it is. What's interesting is I walked up here today. Somebody has a big book up here. I don't know if it's the International's big book or if somebody from the last panel left it here, but it's got a bookmark in it. And when I opened it up to see where it was, the bookmark was, it's got a paragraph underlined. It's the only thing underlined on the whole page that's bookmarked. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. And I read that, and this is not a new thought, but it reminded me that just for today, I not only have a reprieve from the terror of alcohol in my life and the freedom from taking a drink and living that way, I have a promise of a day at a time of the freedom from the bondage of self, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And you know, I cannot maintain my spiritual condition tomorrow. I can't maintain my spiritual condition by remembering what happened yesterday. I have to maintain my spiritual condition at this very moment, right now. I can't even do it at 6 o'clock tonight, yet. Hopefully I'll be working on it at 6 o'clock tonight. And this is, you know, from our 10th step in the big book, and the pages that, when I think one day at a time or just for today, pages 84 through 88 in the big book, which are a prescription for me on how to live one day at a time. It's on the 10th and 11th step. And it suggests how we start our day, suggests that I might start my day in prayer and asking God to direct my thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-seeking, dishonest motives. I'm not good at quoting this, so I'm kind of, don't take out your pen and come up right later and remind me which word I had wrong, because I'm just trying to, I like to paraphrase it because I can always paraphrase it to my best advantage that way. But it asks that God, that I ask God to direct my thinking, especially letting me get in touch with my motives and free me of the motives that are natural for me. I am pretty much motivated by selfish, self-centered thoughts left to my own devices. And I love that we talk a lot about it, you know, it's a thinking disease, and the worst, it's the worst words you can hear from an alcoholic is "I've been thinking" and things like that. But the big book says something different. It does say I have a thinking problem, but it's not because I don't know how to think. It's because my motives are all messed up. And that if I have proper motives, my thought life will be placed on a much higher plane. That's a pretty good promise for a guy like me. And I think that desire to start my day with the right motives is good advice that's found in the big book, to ask God to help me get my intentions, my motives, my hopes for the day for myself, for the kind of person I want to be, the way I want to live, right, and to ask God for the power to do that. It suggests as I go through the day that I ask God for the next thought, next action I should be taking. I am in touch. I'm on my third sponsor. The first two have unfortunately are both passed away, and the one I had before was this remarkable spiritual man. And he used to talk about practice the presence of God. That was his phrase for that, is to be conscious that God is present. Intellectually, I can tell you, I'm pretty comfortable with the idea that God is always present. But me being conscious of that reality, of being in touch, in conscious contact with a power greater than myself at any moment, is a very problematic idea. Because my head is gone. And I live in my head a lot, and I've been sober a while, but I still have to try to keep coming back to the present and know what's going on. And the big book suggests in the 10th step that we, as we go through our day, we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That's the big book's version of the 10th step. Big book doesn't talk in the 10th step about reflecting at the end of the night. It says, as I go through my day, be aware, continue to watch for, and if they crop up, when they crop up, pray about it right then and take the actions that need to be taken right then. It's another reminder in that directions of living a day at a time to try to stay in the present. Now, that self-consciousness is a challenge for a guy like me, that aware of, am I really resentful right now? I don't know. I mean, if you ask me, at any time, I can put the best angle, the best twist on anything that's going on. I'll lock into an action and head on down a path and be doing stuff and be absolutely convinced that I'm doing it for the right reasons, or it's something that absolutely must be done. But it could be totally based on resentment. And if I have the time to pause and reflect and say, what's going on here? What are my real motives? Why am I doing this? even if it appears on the surface to be the right thing to do, it may not be properly motivated. And that may be helping somebody else, I don't know, but it may not be, it's certainly not helping my spiritual condition, because I'm doing it Steve's way. I can't possibly be doing it God's way when it's based upon resentment and fear. And so it suggests that we continue to watch for that. It suggests that the toughest suggestion of all, that when agitated or doubtful, we pause and ask for the right thought or action. I don't know about you, but when I'm agitated, that's a call to action. That's not a call to pause. That's full steam ahead. Let's get this thing taken care of right now. You know, this has got to get fixed. This has got to get corrected. This has got to get straightened out. It's generally you I'm talking about, incidentally, at that point, but it's still agitation is a call to action for me naturally. And uncertainty, when doubtful, that's another call to action, because I don't want you to know that I don't know. And if we can just go full steam ahead and I can steamroll over any opposition, then we don't have to deal with the fact that I may have been wrong, or I may have not known, or I may have been scared, or anything else. I can just charge ahead. But the book suggests that I practice, that I develop a practice of, when agitated or doubtful, pausing and asking God for the right thought or action. That means I have to continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I have to know when it's there. I'm an autopilot kind of guy. You know, we talk a lot about driving down the street and then suddenly realize that we're 8 blocks past where we were because our heads are running. I live a lot of my life that way. I don't have to be in a car to do that. I can be walking through the lobby and I'm on the other side of the assembly hall and I'm not even sure how I got there because I've just gone on autopilot, or my head is thinking about something else. This idea of coming back to the moment and following these suggestions of asking God for the next right thought or action, continuing to try and stay aware of what's really going on with me, and as my last sponsor, being self-conscious and God-conscious at the moment is the suggestion. And then it does suggest that at the end of the day, since I'm not likely to have done it all right all day, is that it's a good idea to stop and reflect on the day and ask, okay, when was I selfish and dishonest or afraid during the day and I just didn't recognize it or wasn't willing to deal with it? And then it has suggestions for what to do about that. Take care of the problems that you've caused, make the amends at that point if you're necessary, and ask God for the strength to do better tomorrow. And that basically let go of today. Whatever happened today is where I was. I'm not perfect. We claim only spiritual progress, not perfection. And, you know, when you put together the directions on 84 through 88, and then I also look at the 12 and 12, has this wonderful line in the 12 and 12, it's actually in the 11th step, where it says there's a direct link between self-examination, meditation, and prayer. Taken separately, they can bring great relief and benefit, but I forgot the exact word, interwoven together and logically related, they form an unshakable foundation for life. And so when I think about just for today, the challenge for a guy like me, this is not something that is natural for me, but my prayers start in the morning, my meditation starts in the morning, with the willingness and God's power to stay present in the moment and know what's going on and recognize that the inventory work I'm going to do, the self-examination, needs to be done in the context of prayer and meditation, and the prayer and meditation needs to be reflective of the self-examination, that we really don't have a distinct 10th and 11th step. We have an unshakable foundation for life that is captured in the 10th and 11th step. It is, as the big book says, we have entered the world of the Spirit after 9 steps. We have entered the world of the Spirit, and our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. The 12 and 12 says in the 10th step that we have, in the first 9 steps, been preparing ourselves for this new way of life. The 10th and 11th step are the new way of life. To live in the presence of God and aware of where I am. The 12th step, in my opinion, and this is only an opinion, but 12th step flows from the 10th and 11th step. If I'm in God's presence and I'm turning my life over to God and I'm trying to be aware of where I am, I'm going to get the direction I need of where I need to go be of service and what I need to do. If, on the other hand, I'm looking at our area and deciding which jobs need to be done by somebody of my ability, I'm probably not worrying too much about where I ought to be directed. I'm not in the 10th and 11th step. I'm not bringing God into that. I'm just figuring it out for myself where my ego wants me to be. So I think that for me, as I grateful that passage showed up, because for me, the whole idea of one day at a time, the whole idea of just for now is just for now. And it is a matter of knowing who I am and what I am now. And more importantly, being conscious of the presence of God. And as the prayer of St. Francis said, to try to get myself out of the way enough to let that channel, to be a channel of God's peace and let God work through me. I'm grateful that you're all here today. Thank you.